Welcome to the Active Digital Podcast, brought to you by your co-hosts, Joe Wimble-Groves and Simon Reynolds. Joe is an author and the co-owner of Active Digital Communications. Simon is a Formula One driver performance coach and previously worked for the McLaren F1 team for over a decade. Join us to learn from elite athletes and entrepreneurs to discover why optimizing your human performance is integral to the success of every business.
When considering what technologies you might need to leverage your business, there are a few things you might like to consider. The first is about giving the right devices to your team, the right mobile devices, the right tablets, and the right laptops. Secondly, it's about securing those devices, considering the data that you hold on them, both personal and business, and ensuring that that data is kept secure. And once you've done that, it's about all the exciting stuff, giving you the right tools to enable you to collaborate in lots of new digital ways. In this episode, we speak to Ant Morse, Head of Digital Solutions at Virgin Media O2. Ant shares his career journey in technology with us and highlights some of his best advice on how businesses can use technology to accelerate business growth. As an O2 Direct partner ourselves here at Active Digital, we are thrilled to welcome Ant to the podcast. His knowledge and wisdom is so thought-provoking, and we hope you enjoy it as much as we do.
Ant, it's so lovely to have you on the podcast. Lovely to see your face.
Hi, Jill. Great to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Oh, it's been, I always said to Simon, I went, we have to have Ant Morse on the podcast because you are such an interesting guy to chat to, especially about talking about technology and the future of tech. And not just that, I think everything that we've seen over the last 18 months or so, I know that you've got some good views that you, and words of wisdom that you might share on where businesses are at the moment, what they've been through, but also, you know, what that future path looks like as well. So, yeah, it'd be great to dive into some chat with you. But what I would love to know, first of all, is, you know, tell us a bit about yourself, Ant, and also how you got into the tech industry.
Sure. Well, I'm the Head of Digital Solutions and Innovation at Virgin Media O2. My journey into technology started many, many years ago now. Back in the mid-90s, I joined what was then Cellnet, which is our former company in the original network. I guess we were just a mobile-only business at the time. We started to see the introduction in the late 90s and early noughties of data services, which were very basic at the time. But the bit that interests me most is you could see the potential. You could see what things that, you know, applications and use cases may come around. And then we started to see the speeds increase, services evolve, lots of innovation. Obviously, we had things like the BlackBerry device, the iPhone, and really many, many early into that transition of digital services, I started to see the possibilities, look at some of that innovation, and I was hooked. And I think it's probably safe to say that it became a bit more than a job at that point, looking at where it was really transforming industries. It wasn't just about business. You know, there were some big progressions in health and automation as well. So yeah, it became a bit more than just a day job.
And now Head of Digital, we know big responsibility in this digital world that we live in. How are you driving that?
Sure, yes. And I think, you know, if we weren't popular before COVID, we were incredibly popular now. So as everybody, you know, started to work from home, and many organizations have been doing this for many, many years, we've been able to support them in that transition and transformation and just really give them guidance and advice as to how to do it well. I mean, obviously, COVID lands, there's this huge acceleration. But, you know, it was great to be able to help people and organizations deploy their workforce remotely and quickly being the operative word.
So how many people work within your team, Ant? Because, you know, you've been the voice of digital transformation. You've spoken with us at an Apple event. You know, that was 3 years ago and you were talking about digital transformation then, long before COVID. So, you know, how are you and your team? What conversations are you having with customers, businesses in general, to say this is what they have been doing, what this is what they need to be doing? Because some people aren't ready for big changes, or they weren't ready for big changes.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think we've been fortunate to take a step back over the years. And as you say, this is nothing new. You know, those early noughties devices and the iPhone coming in really kind of gave people solutions that were usable. Then if we fast forward to services such as Office 365, Microsoft Teams, you know, this is when it really did work. And I guess it's really quite fortunate that those services were there. You know, if we'd have gone back some years earlier, you know, work, lockdown, work, remote working may have looked slightly different. Again, nothing new. The services have been there, they've progressed and they've evolved to be far more useful solutions than they are today. But we've been working with customers in transformation for many, many years before that. What sort of conversations are we having? It's really these two kind of drivers, I guess. One is, what could they do differently? How could they potentially gain competitive edge, but be more efficient is generally the use case. That's one driver. And I think, you know, in natural innovation and new services have allowed that. And it's, how can people differentiate their organization, whether it's being more flexible, respond quicker? You know, customers want interaction. They want, you know, instancy. We're a now generation. You know, we don't want to wait. You know, if we pause on a website, we switch off, we go to somewhere else. You know, businesses have to embrace that. So I think natural efficiency is one area. The other area is competitive risk as well. This transformation will not stop and wait for people to consider, you know, what they should do. It will happen. And it's whether or not businesses and organizations can respond quickly enough to it. So we see two things. We see that kind of proactive, help us innovate, help us evolve and look and feel different. And we work with many organizations around, you know, no topic. It's an agenda of what if, the art of the possible. And then these other areas where we are helping businesses manage transformation in their industry that potentially they weren't ready for or they didn't foresee. We talk about this term exponential growth, and it's a little overused, but it's the only real term. Is, you know, it's the doubling of doubling. It goes back to a trend which is mentioned in the 70s called Moore's Law, where everything doubled in power, reduced in size, and reduced in cost. That it has been accelerating into this exponential field where, you know, services do more quicker and the power of these services is there. And then the wider technology world of competition then drives these things quicker. So, you know, we've had conversations where we've gone back in, you know, many years later from an early conversation to say, we don't think it'll affect our industry, to suddenly the whole industry's changed overnight because of a entrepreneur or innovation that's popped up that was never to be expected. And if we look back, you know, who thought we'd have had some of the innovations we've got today? You know, the electric car, I remember it being, you know, put the news headlines of it doing 50 miles, but that was the limit, right? You know, people didn't think it'd go any further. Suddenly we've got Teslas doing 200, 400, you know, however many miles. You know, it's incredible transformation and evolution. And in such a short space of time, that's that exponential growth. So exploring it is essential. And early innovation for me should be seen as a role in every organization. Many do focus on it, but I think everybody should.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think a couple of things that you touched on there that were really important. Firstly is, you know, thinking about budget. So people are like, well, we're on this journey, we know we need to keep up. Or people are saying, you know, where we are is fine. Then all of a sudden, as you say, a competitor comes along and does something that's amazing. And they're thinking, if we don't raise our game now, they're delivering stuff quicker, faster, and they're using technology to do it. So, you know, I had been reading that, you know, CIOs and people in IT are finding budget to invest in technology. Now is the time to put their hand in the pocket and invest. But I think sometimes it's just saying, you know, how do we know we're going to get that return on investment? But, you know, you and I know that they will, because their systems, their processes, they'll be able to work faster, they'll be able to work more efficiently, and their team can have more applications to work from anywhere, but they've got to put the budget into that technology, haven't they?
They do, yeah. And it's kind of not whether, you know, it goes on to that conversation, is it to innovate for competitive edge, or is it about survival? I think there's certain things that, you know, a necessity transformation. So if we look at the kind of environment we find ourselves in now around, you know, what do we do about the workplace? What, you know, what will the return actually look like? You know, how do we manage the demand of flexible working and remote working, hybrid working, and where do we spend the money? Where's the cost? You know, to get it wrong, to save a few pounds here or save a few pounds there is one example of a potential challenge that, you know, many businesses will face. So they've got to look internally, they've got to look at how they efficient make their own people more efficient with technology and applications, but then also what's that disintermediation in the wider industry? What's the threat there, and how would that, you know, what investment do they need to put on that? So it is a careful balance. It's a careful balance, and there's no kind of this is the answer. You know, it's different for each organization, and that's where, you know, my experts and the wider business really go in and help customers understand it. Because, you know, if you look at a typical organization, the CIO doesn't have, you know, pockets of money to bring experts in on this topic or experts in on that topic. And the partnership piece is critically important to say, this might be a problem, let's discuss, you know, and the amount of sessions I've run and joined and participated in during lockdowns, I've lost count. But, you know, to start with that blank canvas and to see where it takes people to say, well, what are the, you know, the potentials here? Because it's not just around threat, you know, this huge opportunity. I was reading some stats recently where I think it said 84% of customers expect innovation from a brand. They want somebody to interact. They want, I think it was 54% wanted that interactive experience. And I know I won't mention the name, but I called a service provider that I use during lockdown and I couldn't get through. I was on the call. I was on hold for 30 minutes to do what, I, you know, to the service I was looking to do and carry out. A, I didn't need to be on the phone, full stop. You know, there should be an app that did that, or there should be a chat facility in the website that would allow me to do it. I did actually find a chat facility, only to be told I'd have to go into a branch. It was like, this is incredible. So opportunity as well as risk is actually, if I'd have had a great experience, and I have had a great experience with other applications and service providers that I've used, you know, it's game changing. That, you know, that we'll see this massive shift of loyalty. And I think the word loyalty has been really tested during this time as well, from people, whether they're, you know, their grocery loyalty system has let them down, or whether it's, you know, a brand they've used for many years that they expect to be treated differently has let them down. You know, people will vote with their feet, and that immediacy that I mentioned, that impatient now generation that we are all in, it's not an age thing, you know, we've got used to instancy and we want it, we'll see people move around. So businesses have to get it right. They do, but it's about assessing it, it's about expanding the partnerships, you know, bringing in the experts in fields from different organizations. I don't think there's anybody who can fix everything. And you know, where we play well with others, you know, we're working with our customers, working with their partners, working with vendors, working with manufacturers, you know, it's about everybody looking at the problem statement and working out the solutions from there.
Yeah. One thing that's really interesting that I read in the Times actually, and I actually took a photo of it because it really struck a chord. It said that, you know, in these times, the CIO has become the most important person in the organization. And what you've got is the managing director or the CEO saying, I want everything to be the best, the fastest. I want things for the employees. I want the best for our customers. And then you've got the person, the finance director saying, I don't know if we can do that. We don't have the budget for that. And you've got this person in the middle saying, this is what my boss wants, but finance is saying we don't have the budget. And it's finding that balance. But like you say, the customer owns the customer, and customers want to be, you know, things to be delivered quickly. Simon, you must have found this when you were at McLaren, when, you know, with 15 years you were at McLaren working in the F1 team. And for a brand like McLaren, did they always want things to be better for their customers, always want things to be slicker, faster? How did that work?
Yeah, it's a good point, actually. I think I've got to say it's 14 years, so I don't get
14 years.
I don't get comments saying that's. but yeah, no, I think it's having people forward planning, forward thinking, keeping up with competitor analysis, understanding customer needs, and doing regulatory kind of customer analysis to understand exactly what they want, as you were already describing, Ant. But I think in terms of McLaren, probably some of the people that work there are some of the greatest forward thinking and forward planning, especially in Formula One, where you've got a lot of data analysis and strategy. So you have to understand exactly the environment, the predicted climate that you're facing, because that can change the track temperature, can change the ambient temperature, affects obviously the driver considerably to thermoregulate themselves properly in as high as 50 degrees cockpit temperature, wearing overalls which create microclimates so they can't thermoregulate their body properly. So their core temperature increases, and that can then have a cognitive effect. So blah, blah, blah. I won't go into it too much, but yeah, no, McLaren was divided into Applied Technologies, into McLaren Racing, and also the Applied Technologies arm was also electronics. So supply the electronic equipment across the racing world. And there were departments for marketing purposes, so marketing, and then there were strategy departments, and they have very stringent processes that you have to go through in order to have a project basically be accepted. So So that process was extremely important in across every organization to have a good methodical process that you go through. So you actually get proper acceptance at the end of it. So then have a customer facing product. So McLaren as a whole have incredible insight into the world of business in applied technologies and also in racing, because racing isn't just Formula One. It's also there's also has to be a business arm to it as well. And not forgetting McLaren Automotive that produce these sports cars. So in producing these incredible sports cars, they go through very, very technical processes. But so I know and met some of the most intelligent people in the world. You know, I felt so inferior compared to these people. But yeah, some of these people are just incredible. And everyone has in the team as a whole, everyone has an individual part to it. And I think McLaren are also really good at picking the right people for the right position to then collaborate as a team across the board. So I think I don't want to keep being overly positive about it, but for me, McLaren were always the best at pretty much everything. And that's why they've lasted so long in Formula One and in business in general, I think.
You know, it's a really good example, actually, Simon, and one I've never really considered. But I guess, you know, to Joe's point around the CIO is now, you know, under huge pressure. And I speak to dozens every week. You know, they really are. You know, they've got to, I guess, McLaren have had this organically grown business of collaboration and interdependency and intercollaboration. That's now the CIO. The CIO's role has moved far from this keeping the lights on, looking at, you know, saving costs, you know, maintaining services, to suddenly they're innovators, they're disintermediators, they're collaborations, innovation. You know, the hats those guys wear is just incredible. And, you know, the work they do is in that example, they're kind of running a racing team. They're bringing in all of these things, but there's only a finite amount of money. You know, we can't do everything. We've got to keep a watch on the purse, and how do you prioritize that? You know, the role is hats off to them. I speak to some super CIOs, as I say, on a regular basis, and they have my full admiration as to the challenge they find themselves in, and the work they did through COVID is just exceptional. Really is. They might come and move into motor racing. That might be the next move.
I think they use motor racing as a good example, just because of the process, the methodical processes that they have to go through. The engineers are monitoring data, you know, analysis of over 200 sensors on the cars to pick up what the car is doing, and also predict what it may do and how it may behave. And my job is obviously to do this, a similar kind of approach for the driver. So yeah, you're monitoring the driver through data analysis and biometrics.
Yeah, I mean, the data analysis is huge, playing a huge role now and a growing role. I think it was, you know, again, big data isn't new, but we're seeing its importance grow. I think Clive Humby of CACI mentioned many years ago that it was the new oil. And I think that's where people have got it for a while. But actually, how do you refine the oil into petrol to make it usable? And I know we're going down a motor analogy here again. That was purely by chance. But, you know, how do they actually use that data? If you think back to the customer expectation that I mentioned, as customers say, well, I want you to know more. One stat is that 34% of customers actually want their data to be shared in return for a service. So while we're absolutely, you know, GDPR and data protection is absolutely critical to our organizations, how do we actually satisfy the 34% that say, you know me, remember me, market appropriately to me? I don't want to go onto a website and see things that are irrelevant to me. And to that loyalty point, they expect to be remembered. So how on earth do we, you know, take that data that we have, understand who's prepared to share in return, what does that return look like, and what's the use case for it? When we talk about competitive edge, data is a big component to that. You know, this interaction, this innovation, absolutely needed from a customer's perspective. But this impatient generation, I keep saying it, it's us all. It's where we are now. It's not a generation thing. Everybody's in it. The data plays a key role in satisfying our impatientness and need for quicker service and expectation of remembering. But yeah, it's the big data that you guys have played with for years is a hugely increasing role in business.
Yeah, definitely. I think as long as the data is the data that you capture, you can use, because obviously you try and create big data and you just get lost in numbers and lost in what you're actually the outcome of what you're using it for. So I think it's quite easy to get lost in data, but I think especially in human performance in my area, to just make sure that you're capturing the simple data, as I call it, that you can use, and then you can make it more technical, a bit more complicated over time if you need to. But I think sometimes people overuse data in terms of capturing lots of data for an outcome which isn't used.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're absolutely right. It has to be accurate. We have probably one of the biggest data sets in the world, but it's used to spot trends and patterns of movement of people. There is no personal data stored at any point, or even collected for that matter. It's based on a movement of 10 or more things, and then there's a pattern from there. But that's not often the case. You know, certain use cases of data in other parts of industry, you know, I feel are you know, taking it a little too far. So it's important that the data is useful, as you say, but actually, you know, it's reasonably and responsibly managed as well. So we keep that GDPR and data protection at the core of everything we're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things we're doing with the Get Active program that Joe, myself, Richard, and Dan are part of is actually capturing data and getting and have a look at the mean, you know, the averages across the board. Rather than looking at individuals, we can see trends over a period of time of their well-being. So, for example, sleep. So if you take a scale of 1 to 5 or 1 to 10, and you can see across the board that you've got a trend of, an average of 5.6 or 6, for example, out of 10, you know that across your team, they're not getting enough sleep, or their subjective feedback is that they're not getting enough sleep. And sometimes when you look at individuals, they tell you what you want to hear. But if you've got an organization with 1,000 people and you're seeing averages of 4 or 5, you know that there's an issue there with sleep. And why is that happening? And then you can start to have interventions, or you can then start to do a little bit of research of why that's happening. And you may pick up on the fact that people are very stressed, and the stress response to the body means that you have a change in your hormonal balance. And for example, cortisol as a hormone is a waking hormone that we produce in the morning, which wakes us up, and it's great, but an overproduction of it will then create a waking response. So when we come to sleep time, we find it difficult to sleep because we've got raised levels of the stress hormones, or the fight or flight hormones going around our system, and we can't sleep properly. So then you can create strategies to, well, how can we then help our team reduce the stress levels? Well, we then strategize and make planning and organization and structure better to then lower their stress levels, hopefully. Find out exactly what's causing it, and then have an intervention in place to then have a better outcome. And hopefully those averages then start climbing up higher, and you have a more performing team, a better performing team.
Yeah, and that feels like a good use, sensible use of data. There's a return for the user in that, you know, their well-being is considered. So yeah, I think that's a good example of where sensible data is harvested and used in the right way.
So, Anne, that leads me on to think about how you were using data for well-being of your own team, or as Simon alluded to, if you've got, you know, 1,000 people working within an organisation, you know, that's a lot of data to manage, as say, for the good of the people. And yeah, I'd be really interested to know, not only were you using technology to keep connected with your team, you know, how do you know that your team were doing okay? What did you learn from that?
Absolutely. Well, yeah, we talk of 1,000 people. We've actually got 18,700 people in our organisation. So a huge amount of data. And I think, like most firms, you know, everybody put a huge focus on this. COVID for us, you know, it leveled the field. You know, everyone was impacted regardless of how they worked before. You know, things changed for everybody. We checked in with people, I think, was the first foremost priority. We surveyed, we asked, you know, we collated data, we ran lots of surveys to find out how people were feeling, what was challenging them, how could we help, everything from what kit did they need through to their own personal circumstance as well. And we gave people lots of opportunity to reach out. We did the social stuff as well, which, you know, the Gin and Tonic Thursdays and team catch-ups and all that kind of stuff as well. And across my team, they had some brilliant ideas and bits of fun along the way. Different parts of the business took slightly different approaches to it as well. But I think, you know, ultimately we use the data to respond accordingly, to say, well, what do we need? As I say, whether that was people needed an external speaker because they were sat with a headset all day and it wasn't ideal, or whether they needed a bigger screen because it was straining their eyes. Furniture was made available, desks. But we kept it flexible as well, because, you know, to prescribe and say, here's a desk, here's a chair, you know, might work great for me, but actually may not for my pals or other colleagues. You know, we had to be respectful of different environments that people were working in. You know, some people said, actually, I just want a fold down desk because, you know, I'm working in my living room and I don't want the thing here the rest of the time. So it was about keeping flexible. We used the used different applications as well. Everything from trialing wellbeing applications. We used the ILG One application as well. We used meditation, you know, apps and services such as that. And I think a lot of those things are actually, you know, continue to use. We're still using them moving forward as well now. But yeah, it's put a slightly different lens on what the future of work looks like, I guess.
Oh, that's so good to hear, and great to hear that you've been using one of our apps that we created as well. I did say to Simon that I was pretty sure that you'd been using it.
Yeah, I liked it. I think to the point Simon mentioned about the sleep monitor, I think that's really, really good. And I know we talked about that as an example for use case of good data, but actually that's the unofficial part as well, because, you know, we learned a lot through lockdown. It was a tough time for people. And while, you know, people celebrated that they didn't have to do the commute and that they could spend time with the family, you know, they were the headline grabbers. But we saw lots of challenge underneath that, where people were, you know, really out of their comfort zone or in situations which weren't necessarily that easy to manage. So things like the application sleep and things like that, you know, I think we're still, as an organization, reviewing many different services. And I know lots of our customers are as well, because we speak regularly about this topic. But actually, you know, I think to spot that kind of thing and to do early intervention is it's almost a duty now. It's more than just a, you know, we've spotted this and we think we can help it. You know, we need to consider, if people aren't coming in and we can see them every day, then how do we manage a distance? And putting wellbeing as a priority is essential to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the Get Active Digital program that we hasn't been launched yet, one of the things that I realized over a long period of time of helping people improve their human performance over the past 26 years is the fact that people love an initial program, and then it's how you then motivate them to continue using it. So one of the things that we've done with the program, the Get Active Digital program, is it's used as a motivational tool over forever. So the reason diets never work is because it has a sort of start and then a finish date. Whereas you want to adopt a nutritional, I don't want to say plan or strategy that you can adopt to forever. So by motivating people with words, and also video to show them exercises, for example, that are beneficial for them for office-based improving their posture, etc. Also then giving them little bits of information about nutrition and little bite-sized pieces on a regular basis, you then can continue that motivation. So that's something which is an issue for a lot of the programs and apps that are available, is the long-term use of them. So it's a bit like we used to have training camps. And I still do training camps for drivers, and they're great, and you get motivated, or it could be a team building event. They get motivated there, and then they're motivated for a few days. They're really happy. They're really, you know, really into it. And then a month later, they've forgotten all about it, and they're back to their usual kind of regime or strategy they had previously. So it's, how do we motivate people over a long period of time to sustain their well-being? How do we get them to become or sustain high performance? And it all comes through with consistency, a consistent approach to find balance within your life, of your work and life balance, but also your overall well-being and health. It has to come from nutritional balance, nutritional strategies, sleep, understanding how to recover effectively, understanding the importance of just being happy. I'm a big advocate of walking, as Joe will tell you. So getting out for regular walks and breaks, and science has shown that by taking regular breaks, you become a much better performer, because our brain can only concentrate and sustain performance for a certain period of time. whereby then you need to recover effectively. So those who aren't taking breaks and listening to this right now, you're not going to be a high performer if you're not taking regular breaks. And that's fact.
This podcast is sponsored by Active Digital, a business communications company and Apple partner that puts cutting-edge technology in your hands. Visit our website to see our latest offers or download our free customer app by searching Active Digital in the iOS App Store. Built for business, built for you.
What's your view on that, Anne? Are you an avid walker? How do you know that you and your team are just saying, look, you know what, I'm going to get up from my desk and I'm just going to go for an hour's walk or 45 minutes, put a podcast on, whatever you might want to do, and just have your time to research?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was something we learned very early in. So I loved the efficiency of not traveling. I got heaps done, you know, and it was before you knew it, you know, you'd look up and it was 6:30 and think, gosh, you know, I could quite happily jump in my office at 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock on a morning as I get up early. But then the burnout kind of, you know, creeps and you think I'm absolutely exhausted. And then the diary is super efficient as well. So you miss lunch and you get to 3 o'clock and think I'm absolutely starved. So I think we learned very quickly that we had to discipline ourselves. We were fortunate, we had some great assistance from people who, you know, whose role is to professionally manage people's diaries and to keep them on point, guiding us and saying, you know, block out the time, or they just did it for us. You know, they took the responsibility away from us, and thank goodness they did. But we blocked out those times where we're away. We made things like no Teams Tuesdays. You know, we tried all sorts. Walking meetings were a big thing. But in the evenings, you know, particularly in those early lockdowns, you know, we made use of that exercise. The dog was exhausted, poor thing. You know, we walked miles and miles. She didn't know what happened. But actually, that's a good, healthy thing that we've carried on doing afterwards. But I think the fridge is very close by. It's very easy to dip in there. I'm devastated, Simon, that diets don't work. You've ruined the plan now. You know what? Working from home, I can see why, because the fridge is too close, and you know we can fall into the snack habit. But we encourage people to have that downtime. We were even a little mischievous as well, where to force people out of their normal working pattern. And you know, my team works some incredible solutions for customers, and they put some long hours in, I know. So what we did is we'd book a meeting, we'd clear their whole day and say, this is going to be a team meeting. And then 5 minutes before, or even, you know, at the start time, we'd say, change your plan, take the day back, we'll take this time back. And we gave them that time back. You know, we know that they more than put the hours in, you know, in that super efficient time, early starts, late finishes, working on particular projects. So it was the very least we could do. So we did a couple of those where, you know, and I think every time I put a meeting invite in now, people are thinking, this might not be real. But if they're listening to this, the next one is very real. We've got a lot to do. but just to think a bit differently and just to try different things. But I think for me, the summary is we need to maintain a discipline. It's each person's responsibility as well as the employer's responsibility. You know, I can't blame my company for getting busy. I just kind of get busy. You know, that my well-being is their priority, and they look after me and do all they can. If I'm ignoring that, their advice, and just working all hours, then I've only myself to blame. So taking that personal responsibility and making use of you know, flexible employment, I think is key. But yeah, walking meetings are something I'm doing a lot of recently as well.
There's a couple of things I want to pick up on there now, Anne. So boundaries, really important, setting yourself personal boundaries and leading by example.
Absolutely.
Because if you're not leaving your screen, what example does that give to your team, I suppose?
You bet. And one thing that I did early in was while I naturally wake up very early, so I make use of that time, I close the laptop at 6 o'clock. That's it. Happy for the team to call if they need anything. And, you know, I'm available. Not going far, particularly we didn't go far for the lockdown. But I said, you know, let's not work into the evening. We're already working long enough. But the, you know, devices are very easy to pick up, aren't they? It's very easy to spot a notification and just do a quick reply. I to lead by example, I don't work after 6 o'clock. And I actually tell my team as well, if you see something from me early in the morning, do not reply. You know, it is just, that's my efficient time. That's when I work well and work efficiently, so I can get an awful lot done. Also, no one phones you at 5 o'clock in the morning, so it's a great time to get stuff done. But actually, you know, and also as well, to manage their time, if they need to buy time back, whether that's school runs or whether it's something they want to do, do it. And again, I lead by example on that by saying, you know, I'm not going to be able to do this time and this time because I'm taking the time back. You know, I'd hope no one would say, well, can you afford to do it? But I'm sure they'd be comforted to know that the effort's gone in. But we're in this for the long haul now. You know, this is, we're not likely to go back to the old ways. You know, the change is here and it's going to be lasting. We need to make sure that we can manage it and we don't just be busy fools. Because we, you know, and Simon, you'll see this more in sport. You know, we're not going to be effective if we're just burning ourselves out by working all hours. So yeah, it's a key thing. We've got to get with it. I think businesses are doing a huge amount to support employees. I can't speak highly enough of our organisation. They do a heap to support us, and particularly with things like lockdown, with the school closure. You know, we allow people to work different hours. I took advantage of that and you know, worked different hours. And it was great. It actually felt quite novel. You know, I was working a little bit in the evening, but taking some time out to do some lessons with the kids during the day. And me and my wife alternated that. Her employment was flexible. My employment was flexible. She works for herself, so she could create that flexibility for herself. But I was fortunate that my employer, you know, gave me that opportunity to do it as well. Did productivity drop? Absolutely not. Did satisfaction and well-being? Yeah, absolutely. You know, we managed the situation together as a result of it. So, yeah. Let's hope they never do it again, but
really good to hear. So talking about innovation and the future, I want to talk to you a little bit about 5G. So I've heard you do talks on stage and I know how passionate you are about talking about the future. And when people think about 5G, just an example, they think about the device, they think about technology being quicker than 4G, but it's not just about that, is it, Anne? It's about revolutionizing healthcare, you know, the automobile industry, farming, you know, the list goes on, doesn't it? I mean, what can you paint just a little picture for us of what you think the future is looking like with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, very timely question as well, because I was asked this about an hour ago. What is the use case for 5G was the question I was asked. And immediately, because of our history and evolution of mobility, we immediately think to 2G becoming 3G, making things faster and allowing video, then 4G allowing fast video. And everyone is looking at 5G from a consumer lens. Now, it will, in time, revolutionize what we do on our devices. There's absolutely no doubt about that. High definition video, hologram images, 3D audio as well, all of these things will naturally come. But actually, 5G will potentially, it won't start where it normally starts. It won't be a consumerization or consumer-led progression. It will actually be led by business. And it's far more than speed. It's going to be about interoperability. This term called zero latency, which just means that there is no delay. So if you think about an autonomous vehicle using 5G, if somebody walks out, it can't wait to send a message up and receive them. You know, it has to act instantly. And that instantaneous application utilization is where it's going to be useful. So, you know, things like autonomous vehicles, it will be used in that. Remote operations. So I think there's footage online of people conducting operations from across the world, the surgeons in China, the patients in London. And you know, there is no delay. If you think about drone technologies as well, you know, drone technology, I think it's always been, you know, this big thing that's going to happen and it hasn't quite been realized yet. I'm sure it will, but it's going to take time, this regulation, as with autonomous vehicles. And in between all of that, then there's industrial automation. And that's where we're seeing it now. Organizations are building 5G private networks. So this is a network within their factory or building, and then allowing that machine, Internet of Things devices, to interact in, you know, in this, as I say, this zero latency, there's no delay time. So if something happens here, this happens there. And that's where we're seeing the use cases. And, you know, the technologies will grow. Also as well, 5G, you know, while it's this super speed and it'll allow this explosion of automation, and actually, let's not forget, 4G is pretty good. And if we think to the Internet of Things, this is this IoT, Internet of Things, devices talking to each other, actually 4G and 3G work super. And there's a whole, you know, world of applications that can be enhanced by 5G, but actually work really well now. So if you think of the smart city, you know, devices talking to each other to provide services, whether that's your car talking to a car parking space, talking to cameras, spotting traffic to say, actually, that car park is available, we'll book you into it, and this is the most efficient route. Or actually knowing that you're actually going to a different part of town to collect something and booking you a different parking space. You know, these while 5G will make all of that super quick, you know, there's a lot of services that will work there and now. But yeah, some of the more exciting stuff is definitely on its way with 5G. What we'll find then is consumerization, while it'll start in business, consumerization will then take over. So imagine that you're going to the supermarket, your trolley may be autonomous in the future, so it just guides around, it won't bump into people because it's got this zero latency, it can act instantly. And you may have applications on your phone or on the edge of the shelves that are saying, oh, you know, Joe, there's an offer here because, and again, to our point, Simon, around data, it will know that Joe is interested in buying that. And that's, you know, you allow people to market to you where it's appropriate to you. So you'll see an offer on something that's of interest to you via your phone. And ultimately, then we'll see innovation with things like augmented reality, glasses as well. So I think we'll see those come back to market fairly soon. In the next couple of years, I think we'll see one of the big manufacturers release some technology around that. And again, you know, imagine popping on a pair of glasses like mine, but with augmented reality, and suddenly you start to walk around a superstore and see different things flash up in your periphery vision to say, this is on offer here or that's on offer there. But again, using that data set, it's giving me the information I want. It's not telling me that there's, you know, a product I have no interest in. It's giving the data relevant to me. And that's where 34% of people are happy to share data, because services are useful. So we'll see an explosion around those types of things. But I'm not sure if I answered the question correctly there, Joe.
No, I just think it's hugely exciting. I know we've had a conversation years ago, actually, and this is probably available now, but people going up to their fridge, or, you know, it's giving them information. It's telling them that they've only got one pint of milk left, or, as you said to me, might be running low on wine, or you know, some of the important stuff that we need to be thinking about using technology to help us, to fuel us where necessary. But yeah, I mean, I wondered what the future of O2 stores might look like. You know, for example, again, you don't want the technology to also take away the human touch. We talked a little bit about human performance, but also people really like dealing with people, but so much of what we deal with now can be dealt with by bots or by automation. And then people worry about their jobs. You know, they're thinking, have I got a job? Or this car, that's this new Jaguar that's being built, is being built by a robot, which is amazing.
Absolutely. And there's two really important points there. And as you say, I speak about technology and the future of technology on stage, on the speaker circuit on a regular basis. And one question that I'm often asked when I leave the stage is, will robots take our jobs? And the simple answer is yes, they will. They won't take all our jobs, but they'll actually create a lot of jobs as well. So the jobs they'll take will be some of the mundane, more repetitive, undesirable jobs, because technology will just be allowed to do that. But what it will do is it will create a huge industry on the back of it as well. So it'll allow, you know, and this isn't new. If we think back to earlier stages in the Industrial Revolution, you know, think of, you know, the labor force in a mill managing and running the machines, and then suddenly automation, you know, came along and suddenly jobs were lost. But actually, if we look over the long term, more jobs were created than were lost. Yes, there's that initial pain point, and that's where businesses need to plan for automation now. But actually, ultimately, you know, the people who were previously, you know, managing these machines are now running the machines and maintaining the machines and building the machines. And exactly the same will happen with AI automation. But you know, there is a huge amount of jobs which will highly likely never be automated. And that's around creativity. It's around personal experience. And there's two types of customer as well. There's those that go into a store and love to see a smiley face greet them. But there's also people who, when they see that sea of staff, kind of dart left or dart right because they don't want to be, you know, pounced upon or... And it's for a business, it's about understanding those two dynamics, really, as to how do you manage the best. But yeah, I think, you know, robots will take jobs. I think on that point as well, that we'll see, I mentioned earlier, this exponential growth. AI technology, I know we say robots are going to take our job, and we have a vision of an android in, you know, in Chrome physique. Robots will start life and will transform the majority of services through artificial intelligence and machine learning. So they will be the automation of services. So the next time you call your service provider, it's about them clearing you for security by your voice. It's about looking up your previous queries and saying, we know why Jo's calling. She's run out of wine. You know, this is the type she buys on a regular basis. We have an offer that she likes, that she might like here, and proactively offering that. So it's about proactive problem solving. That's where AI will come in. But where it won't take human jobs is that intervention. So if you imagine AI managing 100 calls, it's still going to need 10 or 15 people at the back of that to say, we got it, the machine's got it wrong, or it's not quite what she wanted. Actually, let's intervene. And it's the handover. So it's kind of, I hate to use the word robot again, but robot co-worker rather than machines taking jobs and robots taking jobs, I think is where it's likely to be.
It's interesting as well, because I was thinking we all have kids on here, and I know you've probably thought of this already, Ant, but yeah, in most cases, any job that our children are going to do probably hasn't been created yet, right?
Absolutely. And this is a problem we have today. So I mentioned the wonderful team of experts that I work with. I don't think there's a single job that exists in my team that there was a university course or a school topic in the curriculum for. It just didn't exist. And that will grow. You know, that trend of, you know, new jobs and new innovation. And to that point, I mentioned, you know, these robots and machines and AI engines will need to be built, they'll need to be serviced, they need to be manufactured. Right now, there isn't the skills. And we're already seeing huge skill shortages. And I guess there's two parts to that. One is there's been a skill shortage in technology and digital skills for many years. Now, as a current trend, we're seeing a national skill shortage across the piece where, you know, nobody can get staff. We were up in the Lake District recently and every single store had staff wanted, multiple positions. So I think, you know, if we think there's a national staff shortage currently, there is going to be a huge, you know, there's an even more significant digital skill shortage. And that does need to be addressed for sure.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually, because you have to make a job sound interesting for somebody to want to study it. And actually, I believe, you know, that can be, that obviously sounds like an issue. So, I mean, I couldn't think of anything worse myself personally, of sitting there putting something together repeatedly over and over and over and over again to build something. You know, I'm very lucky that I have the versatility in my job where it's very interesting, and I get to work with wonderful people like Jo as part of it. So it's I think the customer experience, like you were describing, is always going to be an extremely important element that has to have a human face contact. And I may be wrong, but I believe, although we've been through a difficult time for shop businesses, and we've seen a trend of shops closing left, right, and center. When I was a child, my favorite shop of all was Toys R Us. The experience that you had when you went into Toys R Us, I never forget it. You know, that it was so much fun, and there's so much variety, and there's things to do, and they allowed you to play with the toys and all that sort of thing. And then they're gone. I love Blockbuster Video. It was like an experience. Yes. You walked into Blockbuster and you read what the film was about rather than seeing a trailer, which ruins it. And you got really excited and you bought your popcorn and your fizzy drink, whatever it was. And it was a whole experience, and that's gone. And those amazing childhood memories are things which where you engage and have an experience. And I think that it's important. I think it's important moving forwards. And as I said, I predict that shops will come back, because people will have a thirst for wanting the experience of trying things on and going into a shop rather than seeing the AI sort of tech of seeing the person, seeing what you look like in a clothing. However, I think there has to be the balance of the two. So we have to have the digital and AI part of customer experience, but also the actual experience itself. And I think that for me, that's really exciting to have the blend of the two, because I don't always want to go shopping. I sometimes would like to, for certain items, see what it looks like as a hologram or whatever it is, you know, digital version of it. But then I also want to go and have an experience to try something on or to look through things and have the experience.
In
that respect. So I think it has to be a balance, a blend of the two.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think one of the things, you know, when we talk or read about the death of the high street, it's it's not the case that, you know, that the high street will evolve, but it will be an evolution. You know, we like to shop. It's recreation. It's not necessity. You know, we our necessity shopping, we still go to supermarkets, right? But yeah, we can order online. Why? Because, you know, it's part of it's part of what we do. I think if we look at this, you know, this death of the high street as it's termed and people leaving, it's not actually the case. It's people couldn't sustain the model and build that, build that optionality of saying, well, I'll do this online, I'll do this in store. What I predict we'll see is we'll see the businesses that can do that. So if people didn't evolve early enough and have an online presence and give that versatility and competition has, you know, put them into the position and predicament that they're in, then that's not actually the death of the high street. It's just a transformation. So we'll see businesses which can satisfy the now generation, this instancy, this I want choice, I want, to your point, you know, I want to do this, but I also want to look. So they'll replace the businesses that couldn't do that, and they'll give you those services. And as I mentioned, you know, you may go into a store with AR goggles and it feels a bit futuristic, but actually, you know, it'd be really easy for a store to actually put 20 of these by the door, hand them to you as you go in. The technology's there now. And suddenly, if you went into that clothing store, you might only see 30 items, but you could see each one in different colours. And you might say, well, actually, I'll put that on. And the mirror will then change it to blue or black or whatever colour it is you want. So you still get the kind of tactile feel of putting it on, but it changes colour to what you want. You go, oh, I love it in blue. Great. And actually, you're still wearing the same shirt, but you're just pressing a button and it's changing colour. You're saying, that's the one I want. Interestingly, then, it's about taking the services further where you say, follow me home. So I don't need to take the bag out of the store now, and the store don't need to give you that item, that garment. You could just say, I'll take it. And then drone technology or delivery network technology is delivering that to your house while you're still shopping. And it's those types of things. And, you know, lots of companies are already testing beacon technology where, you know, everyone has a mobile phone. Everyone takes it everywhere with them. So if you were to tap on something and just say, I like the look of that, but I want to know more, you could tap on it, start to see a video, a demonstration of whatever, or graphic and text information on it, continue shopping and say, I'm going to take it. Actually, I really want that. You're 10 feet away or in the next store and you can still order it and you still have that follow me home experience. So retail just needs to evolve. It's far from dead. The high street is far from dead, but we're in this, I feel, it's only my personal opinion, but I feel like we're in this awkward transition from huge department stores with 30 items in 30 sizes and 30 colours to more experience-based stores. And I think you see that, you know, now if you walk into the O2 shop, you know, it's about experience. If you walk into certain sports brand stores, it's about experience. And then we'll see big brands come over the top of that. So, you know, expect to buy a car from a shopping mall in future where you go in and there's one car that, again, you put the goggles on, it changes colour, it changes the seats, and you know, and the experience changes. And you, instead of going to a showroom with 150 cars, that'll still be there, I'm sure, but, you know, there'll be these evolution stores that pop up around it as well.
Yeah, I think so. I think one of the things which is very apparent for me, which is something that Active Digital do really well, is relationships. And people talk about communication, which is really important. But at the end of the day, one of the most important customer service elements, which some businesses don't or can't for financial reasons or regulatory reasons or just the amount of time it takes. But one thing some businesses miss is building relationships. And relationships for a customer are super important. And I've noticed in my area that a lot of the very small businesses, like the butchers, the fruit and veg, the fruit and vegetable shop down the road is now worth millions. And people and everyone goes there rather than going to the big supermarkets, because you go there and you have an experience. They have this customer service and the relationship, and you go, oh, I know Bill, you know, I know him. You know, of course you don't know him that well, but you feel like you have a relationship with the person. So I think moving forwards, I think with the AI and with the robotic kind of technology coming through, one of the most important elements that we will hopefully realize at some point is, oh my gosh, we're missing relationships. And that's some of the most important tribal, basic, instinctual things, which is extremely important for human interaction. And that's something where it's missing as well when you ring a customer service line and you get somebody who's reading a script. It's less authentic and you kind of switch off immediately. And I guarantee if you ask somebody to review what the person said, they probably couldn't. Whereas when you have a relationship with somebody, and it's something that Action Digital do incredibly well and they get awards for it, is they have the people there who are human and build relationships with people, their customers and people. And I think that's super important. And I don't mean to just say Action Digital is wonderful, but it's
fantastic. I like it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And that example of when you walk into a store, you know, some people yearn for that personal experience, or they've got questions that they want a personal response for. Others like that, you know, anonymity of, anonymously buying and, you know, not speaking to someone. And for businesses, this is the challenge. This goes back to that CIO challenge. How do you satisfy everybody? How do you use big data to give the feeling of being remembered? You know, we'll think of a huge online retailer. I expect them to remember me and tell me items, but I'm sure the CEO of that organization isn't saying, it's Ant, welcome back. You know, but I said, I want that look and feel. You know, and I think you mentioned around, you know, local butchers, you know, we saw in our data set sees that trend analysis, you know, when people were traveling into city centers, you know, these local stores were heaving with life, you know, brimming with life. And that's wonderful as well, because I think, you know, when we say the death of the high street, it's an evolution, you know, that personal service, those local stores where you do have that personal experience. You know, we live in online. I know the staff at the post office really well now. Before I didn't, you know, because there's so many more things that I would have collected that are now being dropped off at the post office, or I'm returning or whatever. So, you know, we're building relationships in new ways. And it's all part of that evolution of retail, evolution of business, really. It's not, I don't even want to just categorize it to retail, because in everything we do, we're working in different ways. You know, we were asked to present a solution to a customer, and they said, regardless of when this happens in the future, it will be a virtual session, full stop, because our staff are going 100% remote. So there won't be anyone in the office to come and present to. And we thought that's really interesting. Whereas others are kind of, you know, we're really keen to get back together. We've got some sessions coming up face to face, and we're thrilled to do it, you know, and they're excited to do it. And it's great to be back together. But other companies have said, so it's not even that retailer, you know, us as consumers want different choices. Businesses are expecting different choices as well. So yeah, it's no easy task for the CIO, that's for sure. And the CTO and the CEO.
So, you know, just thinking about wrapping up a little bit, Ant, I got a couple of things to ask you. So the first one is, based on everything that you've said, you know, what are your top tips that you would give a business right now, whether it's a, you know, small to medium sized business that maybe doesn't have all of the resource of a CIO and all the interest that they have and all that knowledge? You know, what are your top tips of maybe what they should be doing between now and maybe the next 12 months?
Sure. So I think it would be this. Two things around the workforce. I think this is, you know, we're going through this societal evolution. This is not whether big tech companies want their staff in or they don't. You know, we are, as Simon mentioned to that example around shopping, we're human beings and we like, you know, human interaction. So I think it's about, I don't want to use looking after your staff, but it's for, enabling your staff is key. The key thing. It's about making sure they've got the technologies. It's not about throwing heaps of money at it. Lots of times it's about just subtle services, subtle things, whether it's, you know, an external headset, an external speaker, but making sure that they've got all of those things to access their systems that they need, whether that's in the front room, whether it's in a comfy home office. Allow them the flexibility to move as well. You know, I try and get away from this chair as often as I can. When we do company addresses, our board do a little video and they send it out in our workplace group. I go in the front room. I use my mobile and the TV, mirror up to the TV, sit back with a coffee. It's not necessarily buy this. This is things that people will already have, but it's trying to think and predict about those services. The second thing is make those services accessible. Don't fight the tide of transformation. Is the key here. This is probably not as irrelevant now, but many years, you know, a couple of years ago, people were saying, we'll stay on-prem, you know, we want our systems here. And sure, there's data protection sometimes sees people put things on-prem, but actually go with the masses. You know, look at what the big manufacturers and brands are doing. Microsoft Teams, you know, the investment, the focus that they're putting onto that product. Enjoy it, you know, enjoy the benefits of the evolution of that service and many others that go with it. So give them the right tools to access it and make sure they can access it anywhere. So those are the two critical things. And I think the other thing is, you know, as a huge fan of innovation, I'm kind of expected to say this, but I've been in the organization, as I say, back to its Cellnet days, 27 years. The amount of disintermediation we've seen that could have been prevented by organizations just looking at innovation in a different way. work with partners. We don't expect everybody to be innovation experts, but work with partners, work with yourselves, work with big brands, and understand what transformation may happen in industry. And again, it's not about, you know, changing the model, but it's we've got to look forward, because this exponential change, this societal transformation on the back of COVID, these two factors together are going to either create massive opportunity that people will embrace and benefit from, or it will disintermediate them and will cause them pain. We've seen it in retail over a longer period of time. Exactly the same is going to happen, but at every industry. And I think, you know, to have back to the well-being piece, people, you know, this period of our transformation now will go down in history. You know, if we think back to the various changes in the Industrial Revolution, we're living in probably the biggest one. Employers shouldn't try and fight that trend. Let it naturally play out. You know, we like the flexibility of working from home, but we're focused on it now. Everyone's saying, you know, when will they come back? How do we get people back to the office? Don't fight it. Let people decide themselves. Because while, you know, picking up the kids is important as a family unit, actually coming back to the office is super exciting as well. I spoke to my colleague yesterday, and he was in the train station, and I said, "Hi, how are you doing?" He said, "I'm getting on a train." I've never heard him so excited. Now, you know, that previously would have been, "Oh, never mind. You know, are you back in the office at all tomorrow?" You know, it'd have been shame and pity, but he was super excited to do it. We're social beings and we like to get together. I wouldn't fight the will they won't they return. Let it naturally balance. 24% of people in our recent survey said that they couldn't work for someone who didn't have an office. So, you know, it's not just to focus on those that want that flexibility. Even with it, we can't wait to get back there. So balance the two, give them the kit, give them the access, have a look forward and let this one play out. That'd be my advice.
That's lovely advice, Dan. Any final thoughts on that, Simon?
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head, and something Frank Stephenson said was the, you know, in life you have to find the balance and everything. And the work-life balance is super important. And we've gone through a difficult experience, but hopefully the positives that come out of it will mean that that businesses can find a way that works for people. And I think for me, I can see it that a bit of working at the office and a bit of working at home will strike that balance in the future. And the survey recently that showed that most people want to work from home, I think will change, and then we'll start to see a trend of finding that balance where people actually do want to go to work.
Yes.
For me, I'm a social person. I like to be around people. So for me, a bit of maybe one or two days at home, but mainly in the office, or mainly in an environment where I feel like I'm going to work and I can separate my personal life to my work. And it also motivates you to think, I'm going to work to do my job, and then I come home and I relax and recover. And I've always got a saying: to maximize your performance, you have to optimize your recovery. And that goes across the board for everyone, that if a business wants to be successful long term, they have to realize that their employees are the number one constituent to success, and looking after their well-being should be priority number one for any business if they want their bottom line and their profits to increase over exponentially over time, rather than that short-term gain of work. And yes, profits will go up initially, but then over time it's guaranteed to just drop off. And I think, yeah, sustainability of people's health, both mentally and physically, is extremely important.
Great advice, guys. Really good, really good. And then one final question for you, Ant. With over two decades of a thriving career in tech, what is the best advice anyone's ever given you?
Yes, I feel old just thinking about that, yes. Well, I think I've been given heaps of really useful advice, and I've been fortunate to have some wonderful mentors, some of who I hold responsible for the job I do now. But I think the best advice is a quote. It's from Charles Darwin. And while I live in the future and try and plan and understand what the future is going to mean to us and our customers, actually this advice is going right back to the early 1800s when Charles Darwin quoted, "It's not the strongest of the species that will survive, nor the most intelligent, but the one most responsive to change." And I guess that over our discussion today, you know, that's what I live by. You know, it's not about us having the sharpest this or the most educated that. It's looking at the transformation of industry, whether that be technology, whether that be societal shift, whether that be disintermediation from something we can't foresee. You know, who knew Facebook would happen? Who knew, you know, the mobile phone would happen? You know, these things did. And it's about us being able and capable of reacting and responding. Flexibility, agility, and the desire to transform. That's the best advice. I've built my career on it. You know, it's at the heart of many key and successful brands out there. And yeah, it's something I live by and share at the end of most of my speaker presentations on the topic of the future.
Brilliant quote. Love that, don't we, Simon? Oh, and it's been an absolute pleasure. I've really enjoyed this episode.
Really? Likewise, great to talk to you both. Wonderful, really has been.
Yeah, thank you so much, Anne. It's been brilliant.
We hope you enjoyed the episode. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast, and if you can, please leave us a rating and a review. You can also find Active Digital on all of your favourite social media channels and our website, activedigital.co.uk.